Okay, so obviously what I'm going to talk about is only telecom adjacent. It's basically some of the technologies that allow to implement all those cool SDRs we get to play with. So I'll start with presenting what is GESD 204. And then I will move on to Lite GESD 204, which is an actual FPGA core to actually talk that protocol. So how do you interface to, you know, fast ADCs and DACs? Well, you know, in the old days, it was very simple. You just had basically a clock and then a bunch of data signals that are the bits that you want to transmit or the bits that are received. The advantage of that is that it's obviously that simple to interface with, because you just really get your data and you get like one sample per clock. Nothing special, very simple to do. The one thing that's not very simple to do is to actually put that on a PCB, because you have lots of signal to routes, to route around. They might be far away, which means that at that point you need to potentially length match them, because you know the relationship of those signals to the clock needs to be maintained. This gets even harder as the clock rate rises, because your data valid window shrinks. It gets even harder if you have lots of converters, you know, to do IQ. Well, you need two converters. If you want 16-bit IQ, you know, you have 32 signals. You want to do 8x8 MIMO, you have 256 signals per direction. That's impossible. Like, you can't do that. That's just not going to work. As you raise the clock rate, you also have problem with signal integrity. So you move to LVDS differential signaling. Suddenly, you've just doubled the number of signals you need to route. So a better solution was kind of needed. And basically what happened is the same thing that happened with every common bus like PCI and stuff like that. We moved on to multi-gigabit SerDes, where instead of transmitting all your data in parallel, you just transmit them very, very fast, one after the other. And you encode them in some way. So you first do, in this case, at least for the protocol we're talking about, 8-bit to 10-bit encoding, which is like for every 8-bit that you want to transmit, you're not actually transmitting those 8-bits, you're transmitting a special code that represents those 10-bits. And why do you do that? Well, first, for self-clocking, because if you are transmitting a bunch of zeros, you have no transition in there, you have nothing to lock your clock too, because all of those SerDes are kind of self-clocking. You don't have a clock lane anymore. You just transmit. You have two pair, differential pair that transmits your data, and so you need some transition so that you can lock a PLL to it, so that you can do clock recovery on that. That's why you have the 10-bit to the 8-bit to 10-bit encoding. You also want to maintain DC balance, because sometimes you want to AC couple those signals, so you don't want the DC balance to rise. It also provides some minimal error detection and correction, in the sense that, I mean, obviously, you have 8-bit on one side and 10-bit on the other, which means that some of the 10-bit code don't actually map to any 8-bit data, so you can detect sometimes when you have errors. But some of those unused code are actually used as special characters, special codes that are used, for instance, to know where your 8 to align your signal, basically, because obviously all those bits are transmitted one after the other, which means you have no idea where it actually starts, and so you need some way to lock in, like in other protocol do that, like E1, that's the frame alignment signal and things like that. And some of those characters you can use, well, for alignment or to signal error or to signal other special conditions. Now, obviously you still have a problem that you're still raising the number of converters and their bit depth and their sample rate and things like that. So at some point, you can't transmit everything serially, because you would have links that have hundreds of gigabits, and even though SerDes are good, you know, you still have some limit to that. And so at that point, you put them in parallel, right? And of course, the advantage of having multiple SerDes links in parallel one to the other, compared to the old parallel buses, is that even if you have 16 lanes, those The timing between those doesn't have to be perfect. Each of them is self-clocked. They have to run at the same rate, obviously, but there can be skew between them. They don't have to be perfectly aligned, which makes the routing much easier. And actually aligning the data will be the problem for somebody else. That's my fault, I forgot to disable the... Yes, exactly. Some skew is allowed, but there is still some problem because there is skew allowed. That means that you need something that's gonna resynchronize the data between the different lanes because they don't arrive. Which means that now you have some kind of variable delay between the moment your sample is taken and the moment you've actually reconstructed that. That 8-bit of data for each of your converter, for instance, because all those SADAs and stuff, all that clock recovery stuff, it's full of buffers and elastic and slip buffers, stuff like that, which means that you no longer have a clear idea of, okay, I've just received that sample on my clock edge, and it's the sample that has just been converted by my ADC. That's no longer the case. And sometimes it's useful to know when your sample has arrived, you know, for TDMA things and things like that, or if you're trying to synchronize multiple chips and trying to do phase Korean stuff like MIMO. So for that, JEDEC came up with a standard called GSD204 that basically specify how to use those multi-gigabit serial links for data converters. It has good adoption. Basically, all the modern ADCs and DACs are going to be using that, and all the, you know, any equipment that talk to those is also going to support that. It basically specifies how to take the data from your converter and pack it in those multiple lanes, you know, in which order to put them and how to split the data between the different lanes. It also specifies a whole synchronization procedure or to achieve basically synchronization and a known deterministic latency between so that you know when you get your data, when that data was actually captured on the other side of the converter, or when it's going to be transmitted if it's a DAC. It has gone through several revisions. Here I'm going to focus on GSD204B, more specifically even class 1 of GSD204B. As far as revision exists, it started with just GSD204, then it moved to A and then B, then there was C, and just in December 2023 they published D. And basically they had more slightly different option for synchronization, but mostly they just raise the rate. I think the latest revision actually goes to up to 100 gigabits per lane or something like that. Like it's, yeah. Things I haven't got a chance to play with yet. As far as signals are concerned, you basically get your reference clock that get distributed to your entire system, because for all of this you need, you know, the clocks are not necessarily aligned everywhere, so the phase is going to be different, but they need to be at the exact same frequency. You can't have drift between all the chips talking to each other. Then, of course, you have the actual SADAS lanes, as many as your system requires or your ADC has or whatever. And then you've got two additional signals in class one, at least, one called SysRef and one called SyncBar. And I didn't know to make the bar, so yeah. These are the 204B classes from the spec. As I said, we're going to focus on subclass 1, which has the actual SysRef signal here. Subclass 0 is basically just a compatibility thing for interfacing with GSD204A. It does not actually have deterministic latency, or at least it does not have it in a way that's specified by the spec. Some chips achieve it using kind of out-of-band mechanism and things like that. And GSD2, the subclass 2, basically does everything without SysRef. It doesn't need SysRef, as far as I understand. I didn't dig into it much because, yeah. how the data is transported. I'm not going to go into the detail, but all you need to know is that you have a bunch of parameters, you know, the number of lanes, how many converter you have in your system, how many octet you're going to pack per frame, the number of samples you're going to pack per frame. All of those parameters, they need to be defined and they need to be agreed upon by, you know, both sides of your DAC and whatever talks to it, or, you know, both sides of the link need to be aware of those parameters. They need to match, and that's not something they negotiate or anything like that. Like, you need to configure them with those parameters. If you don't, and if you have a mismatch, it's not going to work. So that's basically how they distribute the data. Again, it's just to specify how things are going to be packed. But the main thing that you need to see in that diagram is that basically you have a certain number of sample per frame. Usually it's one, but it can be more. For each of your converter, and the frame is kind of self-contained, and then you group those frame into a multi-frame, which is just several frame one after the other, and it's why the multi-frame exists, is to be able to achieve deterministic latency, and we'll see why that's important a little bit later. So how does the system achieve sort of a deterministic latency? What they call deterministic latency, but the point is that you don't necessarily know in detail how much, you know, like nanosecond is going to be between the moment of your... I'm going to always talk from the ADC standpoint, but you can assume that it's pretty much symmetrical for the DAC standpoint. You don't always know the delay between exactly when that sample was captured and the moment you're going to get it. But what's important is that if you... every boot of your system, it's going to be the same, so that you can calibrate it out, basically. That's why it's called deterministic latency, is because the GSD doesn't actually cover how much that number is, because that's going to be partly dependent on the implementation and the vendor and stuff like that. Sometimes they will give you detail and stuff like that, but it's not covered by the spec. So the spec just calls it deterministic latency, so that when every time your links come up, you have the same one. And so is that achieved? Well, that's the basically kind of the boot up procedure of the link. When you start up your multi-gigabit link, by default, nothing is going to be transmitted. Then the receiver is going to assert the SyncB signal. At that point, your ADC will start transmitting what's called K28.5 symbol, which is like a special 10-bit code, so that the receiver can basically align itself. That's called the code group synchronization phase. Once that is done and the receiver has seen those symbol and has aligned all its CERDES lane and has locked onto the clock and all that good stuff that makes CERDES work, it can raise the SyncB signal again. And at that point, it will start transmitting what's called the ILA, which is I forgot what it means honestly. It's like Intel. Okay, initial lane alignment sequence. Okay, that's ILAS. That's what it's called. Okay, so something I actually just realized I forgot is this little thing here, SysRef, which is very important for synchronization. So SysRef is something that happens even at the very beginning. It can be a single pulse or periodic. It kind of depends on your system design, but one shot is perfectly fine, and that's what I've mostly worked with. What this does is that it resets the multi-frame counter inside all the involved device to the same value, or to a known value. It doesn't have to be the same, it has to be a known value that's sometimes configurable, but essentially it resets the multi-frame counter so that everybody agrees that now is multi-frame zero, for instance. It's very important that signal arrives to every device at the same time, and that it arrives with proper setup and hold time with regard to your reference clock, because that's how various things are gonna get synchronized. Then you have the whole procedure, and as I said, you have the ILA. And the important thing is that the ILA will start at a multi-frame boundary. And that's what kind of allows synchronization, is that no matter how much skew and slip buffer you have in your SerDes and at different place in the design, as long as that skew is basically less than half of the length of a multiframe, you'll basically be able to guess where that multiframe goes, because you know the closest one you're to, basically. That interline alignment sequence, because you know it's aligned to a multiframe, you also know it lasts for four multiframes. You know when your user data starts, and you know your user data starts at a multiframe boundary. The ILS also contains basically a bunch of, it actually contains all the link parameters, so like the number of lanes, all the link parameters that I said needed to be configured. They are written in there, and usually the transmitter will transmit what it's been configured with, and the receiver will check that the configuration is the one it expects. If it doesn't, it will basically stay in the ILS phase, and so that's one way you can see if you basically screwed up the configuration of the link, is that if it stays in the ILS phase all the time, you know you've misconfigured something in those parameters. Also important to know is that in those parameters are like a vendor and a data ID thing, which serve no purpose whatsoever, and they just need to match on both ends. Why did they, I don't know, like you, but you need to make sure they match, because that's not going to work. They're usually configurable on both sides. You just need to make sure you configure both the transmitter and your receiver to have the same one. I screwed up the formatting on the, of this slide, but how do you, that was just to synchronize a single chip, right? Basically, knowing that you have a deterministic delay between the moment it captures data and the moment you get that data. Now, you also need to potentially synchronize multiple chips, because maybe your ADC doesn't have as many channels as you need, and you need several of them. Now, that two things that you need to synchronize. Usually, if you want phase coherence, you're going to need to synchronize their internal state, like their fractional NPLL, whatever other internal state that they have. That is out of scope for GSD 204. And so that's going to be a vendor-specific mechanism. So usually, you will have a process in the datasheet or an API call that you can make. I haven't worked with a lot of chips, but all the ones that I've worked with, they just use SysRef. Basically, you need to send some more SysRef pulses before you even start raising the GSD 2.4 link so that it can align its own internal state and they get in sync. And then, of course, then you just need to raise the link and you need to have data synchronization so that both your link, you get data corresponding to the same moment in time. And not off by one multiframe, for instance. Here you have two options, the so-called combined, where you basically, each of the Erix block would be, you know, an IP core or something that you put in your chip, that a GSD 204 receiver, for instance, and you basically need like a little encoding module that's gonna wait for all the sync signal to be asserted to so that all the transmitting device see the same sync signal go down at the same time and go up at the same time. And at that point, all your TX will start transmitting actual data from the same multi-frame boundary, and so you're in sync. You have the symmetric case for the on the other side of the slide, but here I'm mostly talking about this one. But the idea is that you basically have multiple independent cores, you combine the sync before you transmit it to the other side, and that allows you to raise them all at the same multiframe. So either you do that or you don't. And if you don't, then it's kind of up to you to figure out how to synchronize the data. But it's really not that hard because, again, you know that your data starts at a multi-frame boundary. And if it starts the multi-frame boundary, and you make, you know, to internally in here, for instance, in your Eric's device, you're going to have some kind of slip buffer that will resynchronize the data you receive from each lane so that you get all of them in kind of the same clock domain in the same data path. And if you make that slip buffer the length of a multi-frame, it will actually just work magically without you having to do anything. And that's simpler to implement, I mean, in my opinion. So not that I spent way too long explaining GSD 204, I wanted to talk about Lite GSD 204, and for that I need to talk a bit about Litex. If anybody doesn't know Litex, it's basically a way to program FPGA. So it's a SOC builder framework that is based on the MyGen Python HDL. So it's not a high level language. So it's still an HDL. You're still describing hardware. It will not take Python code that you write for your laptop and convert it to FPGA code. That's not at all what it does. It just uses the Python syntax to describe hardware. And Litex is kind of a framework that uses that, and it even has absorbed a lot of MyGen, in the sense that instead of, you know, they don't use upstream MyGen, they've re-implemented a lot of stuff so that they integrate better and things like that. What interested me mostly is that they have a vast ecosystem of cores that integrate pretty well, you know, like one to integrate with DRAM, one for PCI Express, and in this case, one for GSD 204. So it's basically everything you need to do in SDR. Some RAM, bus access to your host, and an interface to your EDC. It's perfect. So Lite GSD 204 is self-described as a small footprint and configurable GSD 204B core. I think it strikes the right balance between configuration options and features and stuff like that, and the size it takes in the FPGA. Sometimes, obviously, like Xilinx and ADI, they have their own GSD 204 code and you can use and stuff like that. But since they're vendors, they tend to want to show off everything they can do, and so you end up with a core that has like 6 million options, 5.9 million of which you're never going to use, and it ends up slower and bigger than you need, because after all, they're trying to sell you bigger FPGA. So I thought it was a right balance. In this case, it supports, it's been run on 7 series and UltraScale Plus FPGA. It's been used in several commercial products. Not by me, by Android Digital, which is the company that's mostly developing Litex. And what it does is mostly handles all the details. So I didn't put it there, but it actually takes care of configuring the SerDes and stuff like that. So all the multi-gigabit SerDes things. These have like tons of options. Dealing with that is really annoying. So the fact that it handles that for me is very nice. It will do all the link bringer procedure in the right order and checking, and basically just give me a signal, okay, I'm ready or I'm not, and that's it. And it will handle, you know, all the muxing of all the converters and stuff like that, and give you the data nicely split in a parallel bus where you can access each of your converter. So that's basically what I did, what I explained, why I tried it. I was also looking for a reason to test Litex, because a lot of the times I'm actually personally working with very small FPGAs, which are very resource constrained, and Litex and those cores, they do have a slight overhead in you know, resources and stuff like that. But for this project in particular, I was starting from scratch. I didn't have any legacy to deal with, and I was working with an FPGA that was bigger than I needed, which means that I can afford to pay the price in FPGA resources for an easier time having to work with it. It still integrates very nicely with Verilog, so you can still write some IP in Verilog and be able to use that, no problem. It also has a convenient build system, You know, all command line, you can easily call stuff and customize it with Python, and you don't have to ever launch the Vivado GUI, which is, you know, a plus. So I wanted to quickly go over how you actually use that core, because honestly, documentation is a bit sparse on that one. So some of the cores, there is a, from Lytx, they have tons of documentation example and stuff like that. This one, not so much. I think it's because most of the hardware it's been used for is for commercial project, and there hasn't been as much usage, mostly because, you know, those converters, they're not used usually by hobby projects and stuff like that, because they tend to cost more. There's not an easy available hardware to play with them and stuff like that. I don't know, but anyway. The only reason I got it running at all is because Florent, which is the guy from Android Digital, was doing some handholding when bringing that up. And a lot of the stuff is based on the example he provided. And so I wanted to, if you ever decide that you want to try it out and stuff like that, you have a reference to look at on how that kind of thing works. So the first thing is you need to create all your link parameters. You know, all the stuff at the top is just system design that you're gonna pick. You know, things like your reference frequency, they might be actually fixed by whatever crystal you have on your board. The line rate is gonna be mostly determined by, okay, I need enough bandwidth to actually fit the sample rate that I want to fit at the bit depth that I want to fit. Then you put all your, you create the parameter object and stuff like that, and those will be used everywhere, basically. And see, like the DID and the BID, which is like the 5A and 0x5, these are like the magic value. They need to match between whatever you set there and whatever is set in your DAC configuration. I was using an ADI DAC, and they have like a configuration structure where you set those values. They just need to match, like. Next thing is clocking. So this is like very device specific, because they use resource. The only thing you need to do is basically take the reference clock, whatever it is, feed it to your gigabit SerDes, because they need clocking, and the SerDes will take care of converting it to the multi-gigabit clock it needs to run internally and stuff like that. So that's really all I do, is take the ref clock, feed it through a buffer to the ref clock GTH, which is the gigabit transceiver. And then you need a copy of it at the right frequency. And the right frequency is gonna be your line rate divided by 40. Yes. And that's kind of a magic thing that's was really not obvious, but it's kind of hard-coded that the Lyte GSD core will take the serial gigabit link and basically provide you the, configure the SerDes basically to deserialize into a 40-to-1 ratio. And, you know, 40-to-1, and you remove the 8-bit to 10-bit encoding, you get 32-bit words at the output, and that's kind of hard-coded. So that means that the clock that this core and all that GSD stuff from Lyte GSD needs to run needs to be 1 divided by 40 of your line rate. If you get that wrong, again, not going to work. Then you need to create all the PHY. So basically, the top just creates a PLL that it's gonna do the job of taking the two, in my case, it was 240 something megahertz, convert it to like 4.9 gigabits, and then feed it to a bunch of GTH4 instance, which are like the gigabit transceiver. Again, data width, 40, important. If you look at the GTH4 core, you could actually put 20 there. It doesn't work if you do that, because the GSD204 core expects 32 bits word at a time. That's the way it passes the ILAS and stuff like that. It needs that. So again, you might be tempted to change it to 20. I was, because if I change it to 20, that meant I get 1 sample per clock, which was nice. Instead, here I'm divided by 40 and I get 2 samples per clock, which is more annoying to deal with, but yeah. I'm insisting on that because it's really easy to overlook if you're trying to use it, and then you look for a lot of time of why it's not working. the sysref input, it's just a receiver that you need to feed. And then you once you've done that, once you've created the phi and once you've created the link parameter, you just created your core TX object and the core RX object. As you see, it's like basically the same for RX and TX. You just combine the status of all the phi to know if your link is up or not. And once that's done, you can actually access your actual data by just looking at the core. You have like a ready signal that tells you if your data is valid. And then for each converter, you will get the number of the data width of that converter multiplied by the number of sample per clock that you get. So in my case, I had 16-bit converter, which means I get 32 bits per converter, which represent the two samples I get per clock symmetrically for the TX. Quickly, how do you use multiple chip with like GSD204? As I said, I used the non-combined version because it seemed easier to implement. So you just basically repeat that 2, 4, 8 times, whatever. Each of them will run in its own GSD clock domain. All those clock domains are obviously synchronous in the time that they run at the exact same frequency. They all derive from the same reference clock, but their phase is potentially slightly different because it's basically a clock recovered from the GSD link. So they might not be aligned, which means that you need a clock domain crossing between them. You need a sleep buffer to synchronize them all and get all your converters at the same time. And as I said, if you make that sleep buffer length exactly the length of a multi-frame, it just works and they will be aligned. Some resources. Link to LightX and LightGSD. The specification, you can't download it from the GDEC website because you need to pay and stay from it. But a little tip, if you pretend to be Google, then you can access it. Changing your user agent and it downloads it fine. So there you go. Any questions? I know that was fast because, yeah.
Not a question, just a comment. I guess you know what Enjoy Digital was building that for?
It wasn't like quantum computers or something?
Oh, could be, but I mean.
Because it's used by MLabs or something, no?
Okay, no, I was assuming, but just guessing, but I know that Enjoy Digital also is doing all the radios for Amarisoft.
Yeah, that I know they've been used for, I know it's been used for that too, yeah. But I thought that Desco was developed before for MLabs. But yeah, I know that they do it for Amarisoft as well, I know, yeah. True. So it works.
Well, just guessing.
Okay. Well, thank you.